to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 45, The Skin Book. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss how a prisoner in Charlestown became the donor to the first known volume of anthropodermic bibliopagy in America. With the inscription, and forgive my Latin here, Hic liber Waltonus cute compactus est, and known informally as the Skin Book, it's a book bound in the skin of a man named George Walton. The book is now a prized possession of the Boston Athenaeum. But before we talk about this unusual volume, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is September 11th, and in September 1775, Boston was at the height of its protests against the Stamp Act. After the stamp tax collector Andrew Oliver had been hanged in effigy, after days of protest had turned into nights of riots, and after the mob had destroyed Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson's house, a ship arrived in the harbor carrying a literal boatload of stamped paper, and a new tax collector bound for New Hampshire. The mob was whipped into such a frenzy that they were able to convince George Meserve, the new tax collector, to renounce his post before he even disembarked. They were so proud of themselves that they threw a big party the next day, as recounted here by the Boston Newsletter. For the morning following was ushered in with the ringing of all the bells in town, and joy and gladness appeared in every countenance. At the south part of town, the trees, for which many have so great a veneration, were decorated with the ensigns of loyalty, and the colors embroidered with several mottos, which we have not been able to obtain. On the body of the largest tree was fixed with large deck nails that it might last, as a poet said, like an oaken bench to perpetuity, a copper plate with these words stamped thereon in golden letters, "The Tree of Liberty." A report of these decorations collected a great many of the inhabitants who were at leisure, where they were saluted with the firing of a number of chambers and regaled with a plenty of liquor. So it was on September 11th, 1765, that the famous Liberty Tree got its name.
Beatlemania came to Boston on September 12, 1964. They were in town for less than 24 hours, arriving on a private plane into Hanscom Air Force Base at 3:40 a.m. that morning and departing for Baltimore before midnight. They checked into the Madison Hotel, next door to the Boston Garden, got a bit of sleep, and then gave a press conference, which sounded a bit like this.
Martin Fiedler, Boston Popcorn Courier, finds your music very relaxing. How do you find your music?
I like the tunes he plays.
Have you ever heard of him?
Yeah, yeah. Boston Popcorn.
Very relaxing.
Alan the whole world.
Have you heard his version of Beatles?
Yes. Good
job. You like?
Good job. Very good. No, it's just nice and...
A few hours later, they went on stage at the Garden before a sold-out crowd of 13,909 ticket holders. They played a 30-minute set, ripping through a list of hits that included Twist and Shout, Roll Over Beethoven, Can't Buy Me Love, and A Hard Day's Night. It almost didn't matter what the set was like, because it all sounded like this.
Wednesday is September 13th, and on September 13th, 1757, Boston saw a human take flight for the first time. Well, kind of. The day before, a notice appeared in the Boston Gazette saying, "This is to give notice to all gentlemen and ladies that John Childs has flown off of most of the highest steeples in Old England, and off of the monument by the Duke of Cumberland's desire, and does intend this day and 2 days following to fly off of Dr. Cutler's church, where he hopes to give full satisfaction to all spectators." Dr. Cutler's church refers to Christ Church, which we know better as Old North. On the 13th, Childs flew gracefully from the steeple of Old North to the ground. It went so well that he did it 2 more times on the 14th. The next day's Boston Newsletter recounted the feat. Tuesday in the afternoon, John Childs, who had given public notice of his intention to fly from the steeple of Dr. Cutler's church, performed it to the satisfaction of a great number of spectators. And yesterday in the afternoon, he again performed it twice. The last time, he set off with 2 pistols loaded, one of which he discharged in his descent. The other missing fire, he cocked and snapped again before he reached the place prepared to receive him. It is supposed from the steeple to the place where the rope was fixed was about 700 feet upon a slope, and that he was about 16 or 18 seconds performing it each time. As these performances led many people from their business, he is forbid from flying any more in the town. So how did he do it? Local historian J.L. Bell explains how the feat worked. The important technical information is his rope was fixed about 700 feet upon a slope. The steeple of Old North is 190 feet tall, so even if the rope were tied to the tippy top, it must have formed a fairly gentle slope to the ground, far from the vertical. Furthermore, despite the newspaper's clear interest in the speed and angle of Child's descent, its printers didn't describe him as flying with any apparatus. Finally, to fire off two pistols during a second descent, Childs had to have both hands free. A rope flyer started by stretching a long, strong rope from a steeple or other tall structure down to the ground on a slant. Then after making as big a deal of the event as he could, he went up to the tower, waved to the assembled crowd, and then slid down his rope head first, arms and legs on either side of the cord. To protect his torso, he wore a board with a groove cut vertically down its center. His dangling limbs helped him keep his center of mass close to or even below the rope, so he didn't fall off. And at the bottom, Samuel Breck's memoir of growing up in Boston adds the detail, recalled by his mother, that Childs landed on a stack of feather mattresses. Mystery solved. It may not sound like much, but a rope flyer must have been quite an impressive sight almost three decades before humans took flight in balloons.
If you've never been out to see Boston Light on Little Brewster Island in Boston Harbor, put it on your to-do list. It's one of our most highly recommended scenic and historic sites in Boston, and it's celebrating its 301st anniversary on September 14th. The provincial government authorized a lighthouse for Boston Harbor in the summer of 1715, and it was ready to light by the following year. On September 14th, 1716, it was lit for the first time. At the time, that meant lighting tallow candles that were slightly magnified by rudimentary glass lenses. Less than 2 months later, the first lighthouse keeper drowned, along with his wife, daughter, a friend, and an enslaved man, as they returned from another island in a small boat. Ben Franklin wrote a poem about the incident called The Lighthouse Tragedy. Unfortunately, no copies of the poem remain, but he seems to have been successful in selling them on the streets of Boston for a few shillings. The second keeper also drowned. Then, during the Siege of Boston in 1775 and 76, the Continentals burned the lighthouse twice, and the British blew it up. The light station was rebuilt in 1783, and that tower now greets ships that enter Boston Harbor with an electric lamp, magnified by a seventh-order Fresnel lens. Today, it's the oldest light station in the country, and the only one that hasn't been automated. When you visit, take the time to meet the 70th keeper of Boston Light, Sally Snowman, and be sure to climb to the top of the lighthouse to see the amazing Fresnel lens and to take in a breathtaking view of Boston Harbor and the skyline.
Friday is September 15th. Following the seizure of John Hancock's sloop Liberty on charges of smuggling in 1768, there were protests, riots, and unrest in Boston. After communicating with Royal Governor Bernard, Crown officials decided to send two regiments of troops from Ireland to occupy Boston and prevent further resistance. Writing about that period in his 1856 History of the City, Samuel Gardner Drake recounted, "On the 15th of September, the town met again, and apparently many expected a collision would soon take place, for a request was made that the inhabitants should provide themselves with firearms that they may be prepared in case of sudden danger. It was voted that application be made to the ministers to appoint a fast on the following Tuesday, but these proceedings give a very faint idea of the consternation which now pervaded the town. The officers thought they had ample reasons for believing that, when the troops arrived, a desperate attempt would be made to prevent their landing. They believed also that it was the determination of the Boston people to surprise the castle. However, if such propositions were talked of, and they doubtless were, they were laid aside for further consideration." The rumored attempt to overthrow Crown rule wouldn't happen for another 7 years, but British troops were sent to occupy Boston. Paul Revere created a famous picture portraying the landing of the British troops at Long Wharf that October. Their presence inflamed the passions of Boston patriots, and rising friction between Bostonians and the occupying troops would ultimately lead to the Boston Massacre in 1770.
On September 16, 1774, Paul Revere completed one of his less famous but no less important rides. He had ridden straight through from Boston to Philadelphia in a journey that took almost a week, and he brought a document authored by Patriot leader Joseph Warren. The Suffolk Resolves had been drafted and signed by the Patriots of Suffolk County, Boston, Dedham, and Milton, for example. It called for a boycott of all British goods, disobedience to the Massachusetts Government Bill and the Boston Port Bill, refusal to pay taxes to or even recognize the Crown Government, and raising militias for defense of the colonies. The language was inflammatory, referring to the British ministry as our enemies, who operated with arbitrary will, acting as military executioners to enforce murderous law. When it was read before the First Continental Congress the next morning, the chamber exploded in applause and shouting. Over the hubbub, Joseph Galloway of Pennsylvania warned, "For Congress to countenance such a statement is tantamount to complete declaration of war." Congress immediately voted to adopt the Suffolk Resolves as a show of solidarity. The measure passed unanimously, and John Adams would write in his diary that day, "This was one of the happiest days of my life. In Congress, we had generous, noble sentiments and manly eloquence. The day convinced me that America will support Massachusetts or perish with her."
Finally, Sunday is September 17th. Author Stephen Puleo describes the scene that unfolded on Boston Common on September 17th, 1852. President Millard Fillmore rode tall astride a black cavalry charger, gazing at the resplendent assembly spread before him on Boston Common. Handling his horse with graceful ease, Fillmore high-stepped the steed between dozens of rows of military regiments, their colors held high, inspecting the men who stood at attention under a red-streaked early evening sky. Thousands of Boston residents thronged the gently rising hill that nearly encircled the field, waving flags and handkerchiefs. Echoes of booming cannon, discharged minutes earlier to announce Fillmore's arrival on the common, hung in the air. The president rode along the whole front, saluted by each company as he passed. Artillery and light infantry regiments, rifle brigades and color guards, all part of Massachusetts' volunteer militia. Then the line broke into columns and marched in review before the commander-in-chief, and after circling the field, formed into line again. Later, President Fillmore declared that the crisp display was the finest he had ever witnessed. Bostonians who watched the spectacle agreed. However, this spectacle was not meant to celebrate any great military feat. Indeed, it was only 5 months after Fillmore had sent federal troops into Boston to seize fugitive Thomas Sims at Bayonet Point and force him back into slavery in Georgia. Instead, this was a celebration of technology. It was the opening of the Great Railroad Jubilee, a 3-day festival that marked the completion of rail lines to Montreal and Chicago, as well as regular steamship service to Europe. This amazing feat came less than 20 years after the first rudimentary steam locomotive had been displayed in Boston, and just 17 years after the first rail lines, the Boston and Providence and the Boston and Worcester, were completed into the city in 1835. In a nation that was growing ever westward, Boston didn't have a mighty Hudson River connecting it to the interior of the country like New York did. Instead, we built our connections of iron and timber.
Now it's time to turn to our main topic, the life and literary legacy of George Walton. If you have not yet visited the Boston Athenaeum, we highly recommend it. One of the oldest private libraries in the country, the institution was founded in 1807 as an establishment similar to that of the Athenaeum and the Lyceum of Liverpool in Great Britain, combining the advantages of a public library and containing the great works of learning and science in all languages. Throughout the 19th century, the Athenaeum served as the hub of study and discourse for Boston's intellectual and academic elite. Today, their collection is particularly strong in the areas of Boston history, New England's state and local history, biography, English and American literature, and fine and decorative arts. Visitors don't need a membership to access the first floor, where you can see paintings from John Singer Sargent, Gilbert Stuart, and Alan Rohan Crite, all who left their mark in the Boston art world. And for all of you Hamilton fans out there, you'll also see a haughty-looking Lafayette bust owned by his BFF Jefferson. But our topic of discussion today is an incredibly rare book in the Athenaeum's collection entitled Narrative of the Life of James Allen, alias George Walton, alias Jonas Pierce, alias James H. York, alias Burley Grove, The Highwayman, being his deathbed confession to the warden of the Massachusetts State Prison. Now that's a lot of aliases, so we're going to stick with George Walton to be consistent with the Latin inscription on the book. George Walton was born in Lancaster, Massachusetts, sometime around 1809. Orphaned at a young age, he struggled to make his way and earn a paycheck. We'll let him tell you how he was introduced to a life of crime. I made several attempts to obtain employment in the merchant service as a seaman, but was in every case abruptly refused by the owners. I finally succeeded in getting employment on board a market fishing schooner under Captain J. Smith, a pretty clever sort of man when not under the influence of ardent spirits, of which article he kept a full supply on hand and was not often outdone by any of the crew in the use of it. According to my usual practice, I drank but little. Captain Smith was committed to jail for debt and did not, nor has he since, paid the full amount of wages due me for my services on board his vessel. 2 or 3 days after leaving the vessel, I was requested by a man, a stranger to me, to assist him in carrying a trunk, which I presumed was his own property, to a house on Suffolk Street, Boston. On noticing the man more closely, I observed he looked rather suspicious and appeared to be acting with more than usual caution, which led me to apprehend that all was not right with respect to the trunk. I learned afterwards that the man was Stephen Sims, an old state prison convict who was subsequently committed to the prison for the third time, at which place he died of consumption. Sims gave me $10 for assisting him. This was the first proceeding in which I ever had anything to do with stolen property and was the precursor of my future destiny.
About a week after the circumstance of the trunk, Sims called at my boarding house and in conversation remarked that he knew of an opportunity which, if improved, would lead to securing a fortune. We proceeded together to his residence when he unfolded to me his place of operation, which was to break a store at the corner of Charles and Beacon Streets and obtain possession of a large quantity of specie and bank bills, which he thought was left in the store by the occupant. After considerable conversation, I concluded to make the attempt, and between 11 and 12 o'clock of that night, we proceeded to the store, which I succeeded, by means of a ladder, in entering at one of the windows in the second story. Sims remained outside for the purpose of removing the ladder to prevent suspicion if anyone should happen to pass that way while I was in the store. I carried with me a small pocket lantern, and steel and tinder, etc. We presumed there was $2,000 or $3,000 in money in the store, which, however, we never found, if there. I broke the desk, found some silver and copper coin, and found a bag, which contained $60 in silver, which, together with a box, I handed out to Sims, after which we returned to his residence. We divided the spoil, and I received $30 for my services. This was the first time in my life that I ever was concerned in breaking into a building or was guilty of stealing property, except in a few instances of taking fruit or some such trifling thing. After a short but productive crime spree, he was caught stealing a bundle of cloth from a fishing vessel in October of 1824. At age 15, he found himself jailed for 6 months, charting the course of the rest of his life. As he tells it, "In a short time, jail scenes and the society of the depraved and vicious became familiar, and I lost, in a good degree, the tender feelings which influenced me on being first committed. There would be times when we would try to find honest work, but lawful employment seemed to always elude him." After his release, he found himself in Boston working with a seasoned criminal named William Ross, who would eventually be executed in Canada for robbing a priest. With William as a mentor, young George learned the ins and outs of being a highwayman, one who robs travelers. William impressed upon him that highway robbery was the best bet for a payoff. Travelers almost always had something of value to be parted with. But it was also a very dangerous endeavor in which one risks his life, and harsh punishment if caught. On the need to defend his life, George reasoned, "No one but a coward would take human life except in self-defense. And even if I was robbing a man, and found it necessary to kill him in order to save my own life, I should not think it wrong. It would merely be acting in self-defense. From that initial arrest in 1824 up through 1832, George was in and out of prison. His preference was to rob merchants, as they would have a full wallet from the day's sales, or, if it was a slow day, at least he'd make off with the goods he could sell himself. One fateful day, he spotted a man with a full pocketbook at market in Boston, and asked around to learn who the man was. He learned that this fellow would be heading home north through Chelsea on the Salem Turnpike. To prepare for the robbery, he rented a horse and found a spot about a mile and a half from the Chelsea Bridge. He tied his horse along a side lane, covered the light-colored mare with his coat to keep it from being detected, and hid behind a fence. He waited about 2 hours before he recognized the man from the market approaching, driving a wagon with a male passenger. George approached the wagon, grabbed the bridle of the horse, showed his pistol, and demanded, "Your money or your life?"
This is where things take an interesting turn. The second man immediately jumped down from the wagon and took off running down the lane where George's horse was tied. George approached the merchant, John Fenno, who grabbed him by the shoulders, jumped down from the wagon seat, and began grappling with him. For those of you who are fans of RuPaul's Drag Race, you can imagine Mr. Fenno saying,
"Not today, Satan, not today."
In the scuffle, George intends to fire a warning shot over John's shoulder. He writes, "As I could not well clear myself of him, I endeavored to fire my pistol near his ear, not intending, however, to kill him, but did not much care whether I shot off a part of his ear or not." But as he's raising his pistol, he fires too soon. The bullet hits John Fenno in the chest and he falls over. As George is fleeing to the place where he left his horse, he thinks to himself that that was a different sort of man than any he had met before. He returns to check on the state of Fenno and, seeing him stand up, flees into Boston, returns his horse, and returns to the boarding house to lay low. And in the few days that followed, George didn't think much of the situation. It was just another failed attempt. $100 reward was offered for his capture, but he didn't leave town. He just stayed home for a few days. But, as luck would have it, John Fenno was the friend of a prison guard who was more than well acquainted with George Walton. And upon hearing the details of the crime and the physical description of the robber, this friend urged Fenno to seek Walton's arrest at all cost. And the $100 reward proved a strong incentive to a former criminal accomplice of Walton's who went by the name of John Wade. Aware of his precarious situation and suspicious of anything unusual, George actually spotted John Wade approaching his boarding house with a stranger and fled through a rear exit. But the next day, Wade would return, and the scene is detailed in Walton's book. A few days after my affair with Mr. Fenno, John Wade, as I have since been informed, communicated his suspicions to an acquaintance of his, and they came to Boston, and Wade sought out my boarding house, which at that time was in West Boston, and conducted the man to it. Discovering from a window the approach of Mr. Wade with a stranger in company, I left the house, requesting that the persons within, if anyone called for me, say that I did not board there. They were so informed and went off. I shortly after returned to the house again. The evening of the next day, Wade made another call at the house and found me at home. Requesting a private interview, we retired to a private room together. Here, he proposed a plan for making a raise, said he was short of funds and thought that a store, which he mentioned situated on India Street, could be entered, and that we might succeed in obtaining a large quantity of money, which, he had been informed, was deposited there, and that the clerk of the store would participate in the undertaking. The interview resulted in an agreement to make an effort, and we decided to have a horse and sleigh in readiness for the occasion. Wade, doubtless, thought that he had laid a fine trap in which he intended I should be second. He did not think, I presume, that I suspected his motives and object. I agreed, to be sure, to accompany him, but had no intention of fulfilling my agreement. On his taking leave at the door of my boarding house, I went immediately into my sleeping room, secured my clothing, and, entering the house next to that in which we had the interview together, took a good position for observing his movements. In about half an hour, he made his appearance accompanied by several of the police officers and other persons. The house was surrounded and every part of the premises searched, as I was afterwards informed, but they did not succeed in obtaining their object.
Okay, so now George is worried, and he decides to go on the lam. He finds a ship headed to the West Indies, negotiates passage with an advance of $25, and returns to the boarding house to pack up his belongings.
And here is where I just have to give you listeners some straight advice. If researching this podcast has taught me one thing, it is that when escape is in sight, do not look back. Don't stop for breakfast. Don't go back to pack a suitcase. Just go.
So, as you can guess, George's escape is thwarted. About 10 minutes after his arrival at the boarding house, several police officers arrive to arrest him. He had hidden his pistols off-site. He can't recall if they were in a stable or in an outhouse, but either way, he couldn't escape and was taken without difficulty. In February of 1834, he was convicted and sentenced to 20 years of hard labor in the Charlestown State Prison. Before long, George begins to plot an escape, and being suspected, he's placed into solitary confinement. While in solitary, he attempts suicide with his suspenders, but the buckle snaps under his weight. He interprets this as a good omen, which snaps him out of depression, and again has him thinking about escape. His plan is straight out of the movies. After a careful examination of my cell, I discovered that the walls of the old prison were not so well constructed as those of the new building, which is now the place of confinement for all the convicts out of the hospital. Tools, however, were necessary to ensure success in any attempt to break out. Nothing, in fact, could be accomplished without them, and as none were within my reach, how to obtain them was the important question. One day, while enjoying my walk in the arch for exercise, accompanied by the officer as usual, I succeeded by a rapid movement, unobserved by the officer, in disengaging from the cell door one of the fastenings, and threw it onto my hammock. Shortly after, I stepped into my cell and was locked up. The article secured was a piece of iron which, though crooked, yet was calculated to be of considerable service to me. The iron was not missed, as the door to which it belonged was seldom fastened. I found means to secure the iron in such a way as to keep it from the eye of the inspecting officer. Having made all arrangements within my power, on the night of the 13th of September 1834, I made a final effort and succeeded in moving a heavy stone, which was supposed to be well secured by irons, etc., by moving it nearly half its length into my cell, and forcing it on one side sufficiently to fill up the opening for light and air to my cell. By so doing, I had a passage for my body about 9 inches wide and 22 inches in height, the stone filling the space between the two small openings for the admission of light and air. Through this space of 22 by 9 inches, I passed into the yard, succeeded in obtaining an old greatcoat to protect me from the observation of anyone I might meet on the road, crossed one of the bridges leading into the city, and directed my course without delay to the house of an acquaintance residing at West Boston, where I was readily supplied with money and clothing. With this good start, he travels to his hometown of Lancaster by foot, where he then steals a horse to journey north. Stopping along the way to steal food and money, he makes his way to Burlington, Vermont, and then onward to Montreal. At this point, he gives up the life of a highwayman and becomes a common burglar, breaking into about 15 stores in his first 6 months in the city. This crime spree does not go undetected, with many shopkeepers insisting that a Yankee or Englishman must be behind the thefts. Now, you'd think he'd be trying to keep a low profile, but George has a very notable run-in with a fellow ne'er-do-well. One night, he observes an Irishman steal a pocketbook from a seamstress who had just been paid for her work. He demands that the thief return the money, making a public spectacle of it. This is an odd turn of events, and he doesn't reveal what his motivations were. He pays a price, though, as later that night the Irishman stabs him in the back of the head. He presses charges, and spends several weeks in care of a physician.
Never one to stay out of trouble for too long, George plans perhaps his biggest crime yet, the robbery of a jewelry store. He works with a partner who will take the jewels to New York to sell them, and then split the proceeds. Suspected of the crime, and with an $800 reward hanging over their heads, both men flee back across the border to Burlington. His accomplice heads to New York, but George plans a stop in Boston.
Again, take it from an amateur historian, folks, and do not return to the scene of the crime.
On March 30th, 1835, George returns to Boston and stables his horse on Cambridge Street in the West End. At the stable, he is immediately recognized by a fellow former inmate who gave notice of his return to Boston in an attempt at a reward. George is captured the very next day. Now, at this point in the tale, Walton's narrative ends and is finished by those who knew him and were familiar with the details of the remainder of his life. Because it turns out that this would be George's final return to prison. Within a year, he contracted consumption, and within another year and a half, he was dead, making his final exit on July 17th, 1837. It's in that final 18 months that Walton begins to dictate his life story to a prison guard. Once informed that he was sick and didn't have much time left, George decided that he would take the little time that he did have to write down his story for posterity, a tale of all his misdeeds. As he's thinking back over the things that he's done and the people that he's met, he realizes that John Fenno is the only person who ever stood up to him. He begins to really respect Fenno, and he wants to do something for him, but he's a prisoner, so he doesn't have anything, he doesn't have any money. He gets the idea that this book could be bound in his own skin and given to Fenno as a token of his esteem. Well, it was one of those ideas that is just so crazy that people go along with it. One of the guards comes in on his days off to help write out the text, and then, after George Walton's death, a doctor agrees to extract the skin and tan it as an experiment with his students. Now, they are able to tan enough skin to make two copies of the book. There seems to be a little disagreement as to what happens to the first copy. Some sources say that it went to the doctor, others say that it went to the prison guard, but either way, it's been lost. So keep your eyes out at estate sales and yard sales. The other copy was given to John Fenno. Some accounts actually say that Fenno visited George in prison before he died, and we know that he held on to the book. And at his death, his daughter inherited all of his estate, including the skin book. Now, this is the copy that would eventually be gifted to the Athenaeum, because, of course, it isn't really something that the average person would want around the house.
For those of you who are fascinated by this tale, you can make an appointment to view the book. You don't need to be a member of the Athenaeum, you just need to call ahead. Anthropodermic bibliopagy, binding texts in human skin, isn't as rare as you might think. What makes this book so rare is that it's bound in the skin of its author. One tidbit we found interesting when researching this episode is that several known books bound in human skin come from the French Revolution, when copies of the French Constitution were bound in the skin of those who opposed the New Republic. These can be seen in the Museum Carnavalet in Paris. To learn more about George Walton and his unusual legacy, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/045. We'll have a link to view a PDF of the book through the Athenaeum's website, with which you can read the text. We'll also share a BBC article detailing the histories of some other skin books, which seem to commonly come from the skin of criminals. And we'll link to the Anthropodermic Book Project, which, in their own words, endeavors to create a census for the alleged anthropodermic books of the world and test as many as possible to learn the historical truths behind the innuendo. And, of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. That's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about Boston's early aeronauts and the balloons they flew in.